Well, it turns out that Nestle wants to place a really, really big order at Starbucks. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In New York, I'm Lizzie O'Leary, in for Kai Rizdahl. It is Monday, the 7th of May. Good to have you with us. And we are going to start with a venti deal between Starbucks and Nestle, the Swiss food conglomerate. Or grande deal. Whatever. A very big deal. Nestle is paying more than $7 billion for the rights to distribute Starbucks coffee. Nestle won't get any stores or equipment, just the distribution rights and a few hundred Starbucks employees. Marketplace's Sabri Benishore starts us off.
Nestle is the biggest coffee company in the world, but it doesn't do so well in the U.S., where it has only 3% of the market.
They fell behind the times.
Eric Gordon is a professor at the University of Michigan's Ross School of Business.
Nescafe is coffee that, like, my parents happen to like, and probably my parents' parents. But most young people either have never heard of it, or if they've heard of it, they turn up their nose.
So if you can't beat them, buy the rights to distribute them. Nestle will retail Starbucks coffee. It'll sell Starbucks pods for its Nespresso machines. It'll get into the middle to high-end coffee market it's always wanted. But what does Starbucks get out of the deal?
The first thing that they get out of this is a cool $7 billion.
Robert Solomon is a professor of international management at NYU Stern School. Starbucks has said it'll use some of that money to buy its own stock to pump up prices for shareholders. Starbucks will also get access to the supermarket shelves of the world.
An ability to reach markets that they otherwise would not be able to distribute to and market in.
Nestle has distribution channels in more than 190 countries, so that'll be helpful as Starbucks tries to expand in China. There are risks, of course. First off, Starbucks is literally handing over the most important thing it has, its brand.
People always worry about brand damage. What are they going to do to the brand?
Coy Noakes is a partner at OC&C Strategy Consultants.
But it sounds like it's going to be very, you know, pretty tightly controlled.
For its part, Nestle is betting a lot more than the licensing fees on this deal, says NYU's Rob Solomon.
The $7 billion is just for the rights to do it. Now they actually have to execute.
That, he says, is where things can get tricky. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
Now, from black coffee to black gold. U.S. crude prices crossed the $70 a barrel mark for the first time since 2014. Geopolitics seems to be affecting the price, with a decision coming on the Iran nuclear deal, conflict in Syria, and continued production cuts by OPEC. From KUT in Austin, Marketplace's Andy Euler has more on who wins and who loses when oil prices keep going up.
For those who follow the oil markets closely, $70 a barrel is something of a mental marker. Kerry King is with the Energy Institute at the University of Texas at Austin.
$70 is probably not a bad sweet spot, so to say. It's not too expensive, yep, not too cheap.
Healthy global demand from countries like China and India, cuts in production from OPEC and Russia, have helped raise the price of oil more than 10% since the start of the year. Ellen R. Wald, president of the energy and global geopolitics firm's Transversal Consulting, says that's bad news for airlines, and particularly for their passengers.
I think we're going to see ticket prices go up because of it. Anytime oil prices go up, it cuts into their bottom line.
Wald says prices at the gas pump don't react quite as quickly as the cost of jet fuel, but there's a certain part of the American population that's particularly susceptible to higher oil prices.
For low-income individuals in the United States, particularly those that had a benefit from the tax cuts, rising gasoline prices kind of essentially wiped out any benefit that they may have gotten from there.
Industries like petrochemicals and plastics will have to pay more for oil, so higher prices shrink their margins. The outlook for oil prices isn't clear. Geopolitical uncertainty in the Middle East could further restrict supply, and President Trump says he will announce his decision tomorrow on whether the United States pulls out of the nuclear deal with Iran. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
The fiduciary rule is set to disappear today. That's the Obama-era regulation requiring people who give retirement investment advice to act in their client's best interest. The rule didn't last long. A federal court overturned it in March. Also today, the Labor Department said it would give more guidance to financial advisors in the future, which all means if you're an investment advisor, what do you do? Marketplace's Marielle Segarra reports.
If you have a retirement account, like a 401k or an IRA, you might go to a professional for advice about where to put your money. Before the fiduciary rule, those professionals could suggest you make a certain investment, not because it was the best choice for you, but because it would earn them the highest commission.
So what the fiduciary rule did was said that people who give financial advice need to be giving advice that's in someone's best interest.
University of Michigan professor Betsy Stevenson worked on the rule for the Obama administration. Now that the rule's going away, you might expect these advisors to stop following it, but not necessarily. Blaine Aiken is executive chairman of FI360, and he helps investment advisors comply with regulations.
What we've heard from most firms who already started to making the change, they're probably not going to go back.
He says firms have already spent millions complying with this rule, so they'll probably stick with it, especially because it's what clients want.
Anytime that someone goes to an advisor and provides them the intimate details of their financial situation, they're looking for trustworthy advice.
Also, the fiduciary rule could come back in a different form. The Securities and Exchange Commission just proposed something similar. Alma Engadi is a managing director at Navigant.
So it probably makes more sense just to keep going in the direction they're going rather than to unwind it.
Plus, Engadi says the Department of Labor could always revive the fiduciary rule under a new administration. I'm Marielle Segarra for Marketplace.
On Wall Street Today, more caffeine. Details when we do the numbers. Tomorrow is primary day for elections across the country and a preview of what may come in November's midterms. A lot of the people running this year are political newcomers from the science community. Just for context, there are more than 200 people in Congress with law degrees, 14 medical doctors, and only one physics PhD. And many of these sciencey candidates worry that the people in power now are discounting science when they make policy. But running a lab and running a campaign are two very different things. Marketplace's Jed Kim has this report from the campaign trail.
This is Luis, is who we're looking to see.
In just a couple hours, Jess Phoenix will be throwing out the ceremonial first pitch at the home game of the minor league Lancaster Jethawks. Right now, she's making a different kind of pitch.
We're Democrats. We're canvassing. We got an election coming up in June.
Sure.
And I'm actually running. I'm a scientist, and I'm running for Congress.
Oh, awesome. So, yeah.
She and her husband, Carlos, are ringing doorbells.
Are you Angelina?
Targeting possible friendly votes in her Southern California district. They're wearing jeans and T-shirts. His reads Jess Phoenix for Congress. Hers doesn't. Has Smokey Bear instead. They're going for accessible. That's why her pitch is short and to the point.
Yeah, so I'm a volcano scientist, actually. I study active volcanoes, run a nonprofit that does environmental science research, and I just was pretty upset about what they're doing to science funding and education funding. So, yeah, I thought let's bring evidence and facts into government.
Phoenix is running for the seat currently held by Republican Congressman Steve Knight. She feels his voting record has been too in step with President Trump's agenda.
We need to have people in office who not only believe that climate change is real, but also understand the steps we need to take to adapt and adjust our society for the changing climate.
A few other science-minded candidates are running for Congress in Southern California. They include a doctor, a stem cell researcher, and a former technology advisor to President Obama. They're all part of a wider push by political organizations to get science-friendly candidates to run in races all around the country. How easy is it for someone trained in scientific rigor to run a campaign?
To win my first election was harder than getting my PhD. You have to really want to do this.
Andrew Zwicker is a second-term New Jersey assemblyman. He's also got a background in plasma physics. He says voters responded to his message.
They were just so interested to hear about my one and only promise, my platform, which was to use evidence to make decisions.
Still, he barely won his first election. Running is a lot of work. Patrick Madden teaches computer science at Binghamton University. He threw his hat into the ring for a congressional seat in New York this year, briefly.
You know it's not going to be fun, but wow, it was way less fun than I ever expected.
Madden hated asking for money, but he was able to raise $25,000 in 6 weeks. Even so, when a stronger Democratic candidate with a history announced he was running, Madden did the math and dropped out.
I would like to see more scientists and engineers in Congress, but if I have to get to $1 million to get past them, that's not a smart way to spend my time or to set up a fight for him that doesn't do either of us any good.
All right, first pitches, please line up the way I put you in order.
Like Madden, Jess Phoenix is running up against serious competition from other Democrats. The primary is about a month away, and two of her opponents have raised a lot more money than she has. As of now, she says this is the only time she'll run, which means this may be the only time she'll do something like this.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, it's time for the ceremonial first pitch.
As she takes the mound, the wind's blowing straight out to right. But she's played a lot of fast pitch softball, so she's got an arm.
Next up, let's welcome Jess Phoenix. She is a scientist and a candidate for Congress.
I asked her if she'll throw a curve or try to zip one in fast, but she said nah. She's pitching something nice and easy right over the plate. I'm Jed Kim for Marketplace.
One year ago, France elected Emmanuel Macron as its president. And since then, he's pushed to overhaul everything from the Eurozone to French labor laws. One very controversial Macron proposal is reforming the venerable baccalauréat exam. The BAC, as it's known in France, was established by Napoleon 200 years ago and was once seen as the gold standard in education. But it hasn't changed in decades, and French schools are not what they once were. From Paris, the BBC's Hugh Schofield reports.
La réforme du baccalauréat.
Depuis plusieurs années, le baccalauréat dans sa forme actuelle est
très critiqué. Les détails du futur baccalauréat, celui de 2020.
It's a measure of the reforming zeal of this French government that it's prepared to take on the baccalauréat. Of France's many sacred cows, this is one of the holiest. Past attempts at change have quickly run into the ground, but this time there's the Macron effect, a kind of national acceptance now of the inevitability of change. Here's France's education minister, Jean-Michel Blanquer.
It's a very important psychological change because the baccalauréat was known as something you cannot change.
There are three main reforms coming to the BAC, and maybe they don't sound much outside of France, but here they're pretty radical. First, it's an end to the all-or-nothing final exam. Assessment of coursework will count for a large chunk of a student's marks. For the first time, there'll be an oral exam meant to encourage presentational skills. And the strict streaming of students into one of three BAC sections, literature, science or economics, will be stopped, giving a much greater variety of options. So how's it going down in schools? Well, to get an idea, I went to a place I know well, the Lycée Saint-Denis in the charming town of Loches in central France, which got one of my sons through the BAC last year. Martin Chatignon is one of the school's directors, and as he told me, he's extremely encouraged by the prospect of coming change.
I've been teaching for 25 years, and students have changed so much. The world has changed so much. I mean, new technology, just the way students are raised, traveling and so on. And basically, the BAC hasn't changed in ages. I mean, the way I took the BAC like 30 years ago, and it's pretty much the same today.
In an English literature class, teacher Kayla Carpenzano is conducting a reading of Philadelphia, Here We Come. She's American, well-placed to make comparisons, and she too is all in favour of the reforms, especially an end to the crushing pressure of the week of final exams in June.
Really, I don't think we need to subject these students to these torturous long four-hour exams when you can really tell a lot about a student in other contexts. I don't think necessarily a four-hour exam is going to give you a proper idea of what the student is capable of doing. And a good thing about the reform is that the grades throughout the year will count now for a lot of their BAC. I think it's 40%. So that will hopefully encourage students to take their class time more seriously and not to put all of the focus on this one exam, this one week, really, of their lives.
Just one school, but the mood here at Saint-Denis is certainly that the time is ripe for change to the BAC.
That's the BBC's Hugh Schofield in Paris. Coming up.
Sure, this is a fast food restaurant, but it's also your neighborhood fast food restaurant.
You know, Taco Bell, where you grab a beer on Saturday night? Yep. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones Industrial Average added 0.3%, 94 points, to close at 24,357. The NASDAQ gained 0.7%, 55 points, to finish at 7,265. The S&P 500 gained 0.3%, 9 points, ending at 2,672. That deal we told you about earlier between Starbucks and Nestle boosted shares for just one of the companies today. Starbucks cooled down 0.3%, Nestle cooked up 1.5%, and Dunkin' Brands Group, which runs Dunkin' Donuts and Baskin-Robbins, gained 0.6%. Some big energy stocks were boosted by rising crude oil prices, but lost ground later in the day. Occidental Petroleum Corporation clicked down 0.5%. Chevron pumped down 0.4%, and shares of ExxonMobil rose 0.1%. Bonds were little changed. The yield on the 10-year T-note held steady at 2.95%. You're listening to Marketplace.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Gusto. Look, payday's awesome, but running payroll, calculating taxes and deductions, staying compliant, that's not easy. Unless, of course, you have Gusto. Gusto is a simple online payroll and benefits tool built for small businesses like yours. Gusto gets your team paid while automatically filing your payroll taxes. Plus, you can offer benefits like 401k, health insurance, and workers' comp. Just for listening today, you also get 3 months free. Go to gusto.com/marketplace. That's gusto.com/marketplace.
This is Marketplace. I'm Lizzie O'Leary. Sometimes it can seem like our global interconnected markets are a product of the internet, open borders, and big data. But the idea of multinational publicly owned companies has actually been around for centuries. Simon Target is co-author of New World, Inc., The Making of America by England's Merchant Adventurers. And according to him, without those early national corporations funding European explorers and eventually colonies, the U.S. as we know it today wouldn't exist.
So when you think of the Pilgrims or you think of the founding fathers, we think this next group ought to be up there alongside them, at least. They are mainly merchants. In fact, we think of it now as the sort of forerunner of our modern multinationals. Until that moment, companies or rather groups of merchants would get together and form syndicates. But this new venture was altogether more ambitious. What the merchants in England wanted to do was raise huge amounts of money. And so they came upon this idea of the joint stock company. And this allowed them to not only have their own investments, but also to invite investments from people who were not actually directly involved in the company, wealthy people who wanted to speculate. Now, those shares were quite expensive. They were £25 in those days, two or three times the salary of a labourer. And so after that, there were a number of companies that were established trading companies built on the mystery company model. Of course, the famous one in relation to America was the Virginia Company. The people that ran it wanted to attract a broader range of people. They slashed the price of the shares in half, and that attracted all kinds of people, not just noblemen, but also artisans, brewers, shoemakers. So in a way, although in the end the Virginia Company didn't raise as much money as some of the other companies, it was hugely successful in almost helping the project of America become very popular.
That was Simon Target, co-author of New World, Inc. At the top of the show, we talked about Starbucks and its deal with Nestle. And part of Starbucks' strategy these days is to put more energy into its physical locations. And it's not the only chain doing that. Fast food restaurants like McDonald's, KFC, and Taco Bell are experimenting with modern architecture, comfy furniture, and other flourishes to make them, well, nicer. For example, in Newport Beach, California, there's a Taco Bell Cantina, which features an open kitchen, a walk-up order window, and beer. Freelance journalist Nate Berg recently ate there for a story on the website Curbed, and he joins me. Thanks for coming on.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So what makes Taco Bell Cantina different from a regular Taco Bell other than the beer?
This Taco Bell specifically is a non-drive-through Taco Bell, so it's intended to be entered from the street, you know, the kind of pedestrian experience. Inside, you'll see a lot of dark colors, a lot of steel. They're kind of using it as almost a prototype for how the restaurants can be more appealing, more of a place that people want to actually go and not just drive through and get the fastest food possible.
Yeah, you wrote about this as part of a trend of, you know, fast food companies really rethinking their design. But one of the things that floored me was that this is not a drive-through, that the idea is you go in and you sit down and you have a dining experience that might be very different from how we think of fast food. What's going on with that change in philosophy?
Well, I think a lot of these fast food companies are trying to compete with the newfangled fast casual restaurants, the sort of slower than fast food places you'll see where you kind of can't drive through. You walk in and...
So you're Panera or Chipotle, something
sure,
like that?
Sure, exactly. So you kind of go to those places and you expect to spend a little more time. And as a result, the interior is designed in such a way that it's not super unpleasant to be there for longer than a couple minutes. A lot of the people that I spoke to mentioned how these restaurants are trying to become more local, which is sort of oxymoronic for a huge fast food chain, but they're, you know, trying to use regional motifs or photos on the wall that are, you know, of the place wherever that restaurant happens to be. So it's kind of this effort to say, like, sure, this is a fast food restaurant, but it's also your neighborhood fast food restaurant.
Is this something that customers want?
Yeah, some of the people that I spoke to, the kind of advisors that work with these restaurant companies, you know, they'll say that, you know, if you do a kind of refresh every couple of years, you know, a new coat of paint, a new color scheme, maybe you'll see a couple percentage points in sales lift. If you do a full-on redesign as some modernist fast food temple, you might see 10 to 15% sales lift.
Wow.
So there's kind of this ongoing need to redesign over the years, but...
Yeah, I wonder if, you know, in 2028, we're going to have a conversation that's, man, can you believe how dated all of that blonde wood and pedestrian-facing design looks?
Yeah. I mean, it could happen. You know, I think we're seeing a lot of these specifically designed places where restaurants are hoping that the youths or the millennials or whatever are going to be taking selfies and posting on Instagram. So I think some of those design moves maybe won't stand the test of time, but a lot of the advisors say you can sell more burgers or burritos or whatever if you redesign.
So did it work for you? I mean, is Taco Bell Cantina going to be your new, like, Saturday night out place?
You know, I'm not much of a chalupa man, but, you know, having a beer there was, you know, it was good.
Nate Berg is a freelance journalist, and he wrote recently about restaurant redesign for the website Curbed. Thank you, Nate.
Yeah, thank you.
This final note before we go today comes courtesy of the New York Times, and really of the life and legacy of Sylvia Bloom. No, you probably don't know her name. She was a legal secretary who lived in Brooklyn and died 2 years ago. But what Ms. Bloom did is rather remarkable. By all accounts, a frugal woman, she amassed a small fortune over time that no one knew about. It seems that when her bosses bought a stock, she bought it too, only in smaller amounts. And wow, it really worked. Because last week, it was revealed that she left $6.24 million to the Henry Street Settlement. That's a charitable organization here in New York. It's the group's largest single gift from an individual. The money will go toward helping disadvantaged kids go to and finish college. Ms. Bloom, thank you. All right, we've got to go. The Dow Jones Industrial Average added 0.3%, 94 points. The NASDAQ gained 0.7%, 55 points. And the S&P 500 gained 0.3%, 9 points, ending at 2672. Our daily production team includes Bridget Bodner, Sean McHenry, and Daisy Palacios. Our special projects desk includes Tommy Andres and Haley Hirschman. Caitlin Esch is the producer on our Wealth and Poverty Desk. And I'm Lizzie O'Leary, in for Kai Rizdahl. We will see you all tomorrow. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.